You made it. You've arrived. This is Peter Levitan's Advertising Stories. And you're about to hear entertaining, personal, often instructive stories from deep inside the world of advertising.
This episode of Advertising Stories is an interview with Patrick Renvase of the brilliant company Sales Brain and the author of The Persuasion Code, How Neuromarketing Can Help You Persuade Anyone, Anywhere, Anytime. Today, Patrick dives deep into the head of the Zoom call participant. We are talking about neuromarketing and how a brain works in the virtual world. We are going deep. This is part 4 of Peter's series on Zoom and virtual sales.
Patrick, how are you doing today?
I'm very good, Peter. Nice to be with you.
Nice to be you. Where are you? Where are you located?
I am now living on the flanks of Lake Tahoe, the border of Nevada and California.
Very good. Well, I'll do this. After this call, I will introduce you to a friend of mine who is a serious marketer, professor. If people stop listening right now, no, you will not be introduced to my friend Jonathan, but I will introduce Patrick. So Patrick, you are really, I'd have to say, one of the smartest guys I've ever talked to about the world of the brain as it relates to sales. So give me a little background on how the brain functions in a sales situation.
Well, for the longest period of time, people thought that when they were selling to their customers, they needed to make a good impression on their brain. So we considered the brain to be one organ. But researchers in these last 20 years have been able to establish beyond reasonable doubt that when your customers decide, they don't use one brain, they use two brains. And those two brains have two completely different roles. So think about it that way. The first layers of the brain that we use when we decide is the outer layer. It's called the rational brain or neocortex. This is what makes us uniquely human. This is what makes us smart. And this is why we think more than any other species on Earth. So before one of your customers decide, they go, what do I think about this decision? And they make this complex analysis. And a lot of people today still believe that that's the brain that decides. But unfortunately, we came to realize that deeper inside the brain, there is another layer called the primal brain. It's made of actually three different sections called the reptilian brain, the middle brain, and the cerebellum. All these together, we refer to it as the primal brain. And researchers have established that the process of persuasion really starts in the primal brain. In other words, if you want to influence somebody or to persuade, most people use rational information. Of course, this rational information will influence the rational brain. But the question you have to ask yourself is that going to have any impact on the survival-oriented primal brain? And the answer is no. In fact, the process of persuasion is really what's called a bottom-up effect. It starts in the primal brain, which is more towards the center of the brain, and then it radiates to the outer layers of the brain. So that's a recent discovery. 20 years ago, we didn't know that. A few people have gotten the Nobel Prize in the last 20 years on this subject. And being able to apply this knowledge to sales and marketing can really help a lot of people.
Is there a third brain? We'll call it the heart. Or is that really part of your second brain here? How does the heart function in a, that's a very broad term, but how does the heart function in a sales meeting?
It depends if you're saying the heart as the organ, the heart, or as the emotion that are typically involved with making a decision. But what's happening is, yes, what I believe you call the heart here is the emotional part of the decision, and that is critical. In fact, that primal brain that I'm telling you about is really 100% focused on processing emotions. And the main emotion that brain processes is the emotion of survival. In other words, although we don't know it today, all the emotions that we make are based on maximizing our probability to survive. So fear is one of the most primal emotions, but out of fear, then human beings have evolved, and today we're capable of experiencing a lot more emotion. In fact, depending on who you talk to, people say that we can experience up to 64,000 different kinds of emotion. But the key, though, is that every decision that we make is based on emotion is not based on rational information. In fact, the guy who said it is a very famous neuroscientist called Antonio Damasio. Damasio wrote a book in 1995 called Descartes' Error. And in his book, he said, we are not thinking machines that feel. We are feeling machines that think once in a while. So again, it's not like emotions are optional. Emotion is the basic fuel that is needed by our primal brain to make decisions. So here's what happens is we make emotional decisions unconsciously first, and then later on we rationalize them, not vice versa. So it's very counterintuitive, but if you want to really study the researcher who has established that, you have to inquire about this guy called Antonio Damasio. So you're right. In other words, it's all about the heart at the end because it's all about those emotions.
So here's a question. I was counseling one of my clients yesterday about understanding a prospect's need for career advancement and for maintaining their salary so their children can eat next week, right? Is that an emotional need or a rational need?
Well, you could always argue that it's somewhere in between. But the concept that I like to introduce at this point is slightly different. What's more important is, are they aware of that pain or that fear, or is it unconscious? Because here is what's happening. Our subconscious drives are a much better predictor of what we will decide versus what we're conscious about. The problem is, by definition, because they are unconscious, we don't know it. Let me give you an idea. We can put today people inside an fMRI. We can read their emotion, and we can tell them, hey, you know what? You're sad. It's too bad, but you don't even know it. So what that means at the sales level is typically the customer have some knowledge of what they want or what they need or what they like. But deeper inside their psyche, they have these driving emotional forces that impact everything they do, but they just don't know it. So the smart sales organization are not going to stop at what the customers say they want or what they need, but they're going to really do a deep dive into what are some of the cognitive and emotional processes that happen in their subconsciousness that drives our behavior. And once you can get the prospect, to admit that they have these forces, they know when you make the unaware emotions become, when they become aware of those emotions that they didn't know before, then you have even more chances to sell to them.
So does a salesperson have to be a magician to get there?
They don't have to be a magician. They have to be more of a psychologist than a magician.
Okay, so an emotionally aware salesperson, I know salesperson is such a weird term these days, but emotionally aware in addition to rationally aware.
That's right.
Okay.
The problem is most salespeople are always pushing for the product and services. Instead, they have to think of themselves as a shrink. So what they're going to do is they're going to advise the customer to lay down on a yellow sofa, and they're going to start to ask them questions to really help the customer realize that, oh, they didn't need a slice of pizza. They needed a guaranteed delivery on that pizza. And that's how Domino's became so successful, right? Because it's a very simple product. So if you think about selling home-delivered pizza, most people, they think that the customer like extra pepperoni, or they want this kind of cheese, they want a thin crust pizza, etc. But that's focusing on the customer knows they want, right? If you ask the customer, what do you want? They will tell you, yeah, this is the kind of pizza that I want. But about 35 years ago, there was a small pizza shop in the area of Detroit, and they established that the driving pain, that driving negative emotion that's driving people behavior is the anxiety of not knowing when the pizza will arrive. And the result of that, they came up with a slogan that was 30 minutes or less, or it's free, and that's Domino's. And the reason why Domino became so successful, not because they make great pizza, they make just average pizza, but they were able to extract the negative emotion that a lot of people are not even aware of. And that negative emotion is the anxiety of not knowing when the pizza will arrive. So that's the key to being a good salesperson, Are you going to stop at what the customer wants? Or are you going to stop at helping the customer understand the deeper truth that drives their behavior? In other words, what is the thorn that they have in their foot that they don't even know they have?
Well, I think, I think we've all recognized this for a long time, that Steve Jobs was very good at recognizing what people needed before they were able to enunciate it, right? I mean,
you're right. I mean, he said marketing does not work, right? So I don't follow marketing. I have a better idea of what people really want than they do themselves.
Right. I mean, the computer plus a phone plus a music system would not have been something somebody would have said before the iPhone, before that great speech, by the way. If anybody hasn't seen Steve Jobs present the iPhone, then they're, you know, missing something better than most things on Netflix today. All right, let's switch gears for a second. I hear you. I get it. The rational slash emotional, the connection and the need for that. How do you do that? And I'll use Zoom really as a metaphorical device for a virtual meeting. How can you make that happen when I'm staring at a screen versus sitting across from a human being?
Yeah, so that's much harder. And here's what's happening. As we all know, most people do a pretty bad job when they present on PowerPoint. You know, I've seen, I don't know, many thousands of PowerPoint presentations, and I would say less than 1% are really captivating. Less than 1% are really getting to the point of why I would want to buy that product or why I would want to follow that advice. So think about it, right? People have been doing a really poor job at PowerPoint for tens of years, dozens of years, etc. And then all of a sudden in March of this year, people realized that they couldn't present on PowerPoint. Suddenly they had to present on Zoom. And Zoom, the medium Zoom in itself, introduces its own set of rules, which most people don't even know. And I'll give you one, because this is the one that everybody understands. But you would agree with me, Peter, right? That if you and I were in the same room and I was presenting on PowerPoint, it would not be okay for me to keep my hands in my pocket. Would that make sense?
Yes.
So we all know that a PowerPoint presenter that either reads his slides or our slides or presents by having their hand in their pocket is not good. Now, on Zoom, how does that translate? Well, do you know that one of the most important things you should do when you're on Zoom is make sure that people actually see your hands? Why? And it has to do with the primal brain. Now, the reason why, if we're in the same room and I'm presenting on our PowerPoint and I'm keeping my hands in my pocket, your subconscious primal brain is wondering, why is he keeping his hand in his pocket? What is he hiding? And maybe you're hiding a weapon, which means you're a threat to me. So we all know that presenting with our hands in our pockets on PowerPoint is a no-no. Yet how many know that on Zoom, you should show your hands, because that's the same thing. People cannot be trusted if we cannot see their hands. Researchers have established that. I don't know it by heart. I don't remember their name. But if you look at the research literature, one of the most important things to build a rapport when you see somebody else is to shake their hands. Because chances are, if they want to hide something, they will have it in their hand. Like, I could hide a knife or I could hide a weapon. And then I would kill you. And then I should not be trusted if you cannot see my hands. So the bottom line is, one tip that I always give to people if they present on Zoom is move back, zoom out with your camera, and make sure that people see your hands. Or if you're presenting sitting at your desk, make sure that you wave your hand at your shoulder level so that people can see them. So this is one of many different tips and many different reasons why people don't like Zoom, right? It's because you cannot trust people whose hands you cannot see.
Well, that is, if I remember correctly.
Hey, Peter, I'll give you another one. You know, we all know that if I am presenting to you on PowerPoint, I should not look at my PowerPoint. I should look at you, and I should look at you in your eyes, right?
Yes.
That makes sense. I mean, we, in our culture, it is the norm to look at us in the eyes. By the way, from a subconscious perspective, looking at people's eyes is very important. You know, for some animals, for example, if you look at them in the eyes, like a bear or a large gorilla, it might be a sign of strength. So we know if we meet, we should look at us in the eyes. Now, on Zoom, most people look at their screen, and their camera is not in the middle of the screen. So there is a slight degree of difference, of angle difference, right, between who they think they're looking at and actually what they're looking at. And guess what? If you think I'm looking at you in the eyes, or if you can tell that I'm not exactly looking at you in the eye, that makes a big difference, again, for our subconscious brain. So the recommendation is, now they're starting to manufacture small cameras that you can glue in the middle of your screen. So I could still be looking at my screen, but you would have the impression that I'm looking at you. Now, in the television business, they've been using teleprompters, right? So it's a semi-transparent screen, but nobody has that in their office. So that's another one. And I'll tell you the third one, which is that even if you have the best internet connection, when you're on Zoom, there is always a small delay between the video and the audio. In other words, the audio typically goes a lot faster than the video. Now, for most people, if you have a really good internet connection, you cannot see it because it's 1/20th of a second. If it becomes less, like if the delay becomes, you know, a quarter of a second, then that becomes a big problem. But even if your conscious brain cannot detect the difference of speed, your unconscious primal brain can see or appreciate the difference between the fact that the audio is coming a little faster than the video. So what that forces it, it forces your brain to recreate that synchronization between what you say and what they see. And that gets you fatigued. So one of the reasons why Zoom creates a very intense fatigue with people is because our brain is trying to reconcile the audio with the video. And again, your conscious brain doesn't even notice it. You know, 1/20th of a second, you cannot see it on the screen.
How do you resolve that?
There's no way you can do it. It's inherent to the technology. So you will always have that. So, of course, there are ways you can improve it. First of all, you want to get the fastest computer you can get with as much memory, the biggest CPU possible. Make sure your computer doesn't slow the process. Make sure that you have the fastest internet connection. So if they sell fiber in your area or if they sell 100 gigabit per second, get that. You try to maximize it on your end. Now, you cannot control what your, you know, what your customer is having. So if your customer is using an old generation computer with a very slow internet connection, So be it. You're not going to be able to solve the problem.
One thing that I've talked to people about, and this is not the best word, is having instructions before the meeting. So an example of an instruction would be to say to your prospect, and you know, I will say that most of the kinds of quote sales calls, unquote, that my listening audience and my client base of advertising agencies deal with is are multiple people at the same time on the screen. Now, of course, it'll, you know, it'll pop up the person who's talking, but that's a whole nother issue, is this world of problematic, you know, where is my attention going? How does a presenter make sure that their customer, potential customer, is using the right equipment, is turning off their video, is doing something to help them have a better experience? Is that something that we can start talking about before we ever get into the presentation? Is that important?
Well, on the technology, it might be difficult to tell your customer, you know, please make sure you have at least 20 gigabits of bandwidth on the internet. Maybe you're not going to be able to get that. However, what you can control, though, or at least that you can somewhat impose, is you can give them the rules of the game. In other words, you could say, you know, we're going to be working on Zoom for this, and I'd like to ask you a few things. The first thing is, please do not multitask, because that's the main issue on Zoom. The reason why Zoom is difficult to keep the attention of people is people feel that because they are on Zoom, they can still check their email, check their voicemails, play with their cat, or wonder what they're going to get for dinner tonight. So whenever I do a Zoom conference, I set the rules of engagement. And I tell people, because we're not in the same room, your brain is going to try to do something else. And it's in our human nature. You cannot really do anything about it. So I'm going to ask you not to give me 100% of your attention. I'm going to require you give me 120% of your attention. So please do not text. Please do not do email. Please don't do anything else. Otherwise, I'm going to be wasting your time. So you have to set the rules. But and it's because people feel that because it's on Zoom, they have the freedom to do something else. And of course, they are under the illusion that we can be good at multitasking. By the way, there is no such thing as multitasking for the human brain. In other words, our human brain can only be doing one task at a time. Now, multitasking is very good if you're cooking, right? Because you can start to boil the pasta when you're warming up the sauce. But the human brain, there is no such thing as multitasking. In fact, there's a whole bunch of research that shows that doing multitasking creates stress, it creates anxiety, it delays the time, I mean, it lengthens the time that will be required to get to the right answer. In other words, if you have, you're trying to solve three problems at a time, it's better that you focus all your attention on problem one, then all your attention on problem two, then all your attention on problem three. If you don't do that, that requires what's called context switching. In other words, you have to reignite your brain with the information that you use, etc. So multitasking is one of the worst things that human beings can do. But the problem is, with Zoom, everybody feels that they are free to multitask.
Is a solution asking questions in the meeting?
So that's one of them. So trying to keep your audience engaged. So asking them questions, so they have to talk. That's a really good one. Doing polls and doing more polls than you were doing before. So I'll give you an example. You know, before March, I was never doing Zoom presentation, actually not paying Zoom presentations. Right? I mean, I was traveling to my customers. I have 3 million miles. And I would always be in the same office as the people I was presenting to. And then suddenly in March, we realized we had to do everything on Zoom. So how do you go from doing everything face-to-face to doing everything on Zoom? Well, you have to establish clear rules of what's going to happen on Zoom. And you have to force yourself to increase the interactivity. So I had to introduce in my standard presentation that I'd been using for years and years, polling questions that I was normally not asking when I was doing it face-to-face. Now, when you're face-to-face, people are feel a lot more free to ask questions. In other words, when you present face-to-face, you are interruptible. Most people do not want to interrupt the presenter, especially when there are several people that are watching the presenter. So the interruptibility of Zoom is much less. So to avoid that, then you can encourage people to say, well, we only have a small group of people on Zoom, so if you have questions, please feel free to ask. Right? You have to be disciplined. We don't want to talk over each other. But feel free to ask questions. And, oh, by the way, no matter what, I'm going to poll for your opinion. So I force myself to introduce. And, you know, on a two-hour presentation now, my standard presentation has about 8 polling questions.
How do you do that? How do you do a poll on – is it just asking people to raise or not raise their hand to an answer?
Some of it you can do that way. Yeah, you could say, hey, if you have a question, I'm looking at your faces, so just raise your hands or – make a funny face, I will recognize it. But it's actually better to use a polling software. So I use a separate polling software, which we use with PowerPoint, and the whole thing done through Zoom.
Okay. Well, I like polling. I like research. I've always found that if you can lead us, and actually this is a good lead into one of your main points that I'll get to in a second. I believe in opening meetings with some research that, for example, let's just use me. I've done research with some consumers, and the first thing I start to say to a prospect is, here's some research I found or some research I did. I use simple tools like Google, and I try to find research that surprises them and grabs their attention immediately. So I want to move to some two words that you use. I'll probably get them backwards. Primacy and recency. What are those words about?
So yes, this is called the recency primacy effect or primacy recency effect. Now, a lot of people believe that human memory works linearly. In other words, that the chances are that you will remember something that I did is going to be the same regardless of where that moment where I communicated is located. But it's not true. In fact, that primal brain that I was talking about, it's really good to remember things at the beginning of an interaction, remember things at the end of an interaction, and it forgets everything in between. So, Peter, I know you've been around for a few years, so you probably had several cars, did you?
Yes.
My question is, do you remember your first car?
Of course I do. It was a Ford Mustang.
All right, here you go. Now, do you remember your last car, the one you drive every day?
I drive a very funky Toyota RAV4 in Mexico. The more scratches it gets, the better.
Okay, very good. Now, how many cars total did you have?
You know, it's funny that you say that. I'm writing a book right now about experiences I've had, and I think I was up over 20.
Okay, so you had 20 cars in your life, right?
Yeah.
So if I ask you now, do you remember your 10th car?
I certainly can't name it, but it was probably a sad vehicle.
All right. So here's what's happening, right? If our memory was working linearly, you would have the same chances to remember your first car, your last car, and any of the cars in between. But why is it that it was so much easier for you to remember your first car and your last car? It's because of that effect called the recency primacy effect. In other words, we remember more the things that are recent, and we remember more the thing that happened for the first time in our lives. You know, for another example is, most people can't remember their first kiss, right?
Yes.
Remember your first kiss?
Sure.
I don't know if it was a boy or a girl that you kissed at the time, but you know, we typically remember our very first kiss. Hopefully, you remember the last time we were kissed, right? But anything in between, we forget. And human beings have that phenomenon, which is like a U shape, right? So think of it as a curve which has the shape of a U. What happens is the human brain uses about 20 to 25% of our body energy. However, the brain only represents 2% of our body mass. So the ratio of calories that the brain burns versus its weight is a lot higher than the average for the rest of our body. So what does that mean? That means that the brain is not wired to make smart decisions, but the brain is wired to make quick decisions. Why? Because the more time we take to think about it, the more chances we have to survive, and the more calories we're burning. And as you know, if you deplete your body of energy, you become a prey for some of the predators. So being strong and having a lot of energy is a good thing, right? So our brain has a built-in mechanism so that it doesn't burn too much energy, and that's why we have that U shape. Does that make sense? In other words,
absolutely.
Because we cannot burn all the energy, that our brain will typically go into an idle mode very, very quickly, and then it will reawaken at the end of an interaction. And you know, again, you see that all the time. You see the recency primacy effect all the time. Now, imagine, Peter, I was with you in the same room, and we were in a one-hour meeting, right? And towards the end, now we've been together for 50 minutes, I would say, oh, Peter, and in conclusion, the minute I would tell you in conclusion, you would wake up, right? You would stand up again in your seat because it's suddenly in your brain, we're arriving at the end. So the end is going to be important, so you're going to be reawakened. Now, as we all know, right, when you start a presentation, everybody's awake. They're paying attention. And then slowly, if the information is not this captivating, people actually sleep inside their chairs. Right? And they sleep inside because it takes less energy to lay as opposed than to sit. Standing requires even more energy. But people would normally go into different states where they slowly but surely go into an idle mode where they are, although their eyes might be open, but in reality, their cognitive functions are completely asleep.
So own the meeting, own the meeting at the beginning, re-own the meeting at the end. Let me bring up probably one of the best presenters I've ever, I haven't seen him in person, Martin Luther King, who used repetition. And I've spent time in the South and I've spent time in black churches listening to clergy. And there's an element of repetition. It's really baked into the African-American experience and it started in the church. Is there learning there? Have you experienced that kind of repetition in other forms?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Repetition is key. In fact, one of the stimulus to the primal brain is the fact that the stimulus that you communicate to your client at any point of time, it's not that important what you tell them right now. What is really important is what will they remember at the moment they will have to make a decision. And usually you're not there when that happened. You know, I sold supercomputers for a living. The sales cycle was 2 years. So it's never what you tell your customers at the time when you meet them. It's what will they remember when they will have to make an important decision. So I've always asked myself, but what is it that people will remember at the end of the day? So I had a chance to ask the question to several famous neuroscientists, including one called Joseph Ledoux, who is head of the neuroscience department at NYU. And I said, you know, so how does human memory work? And in the end, we don't know. No, human memory is still one of the most complicated concepts in the universe. You know, the brain is about 80 billion neurons. Each neuron is connected to at least another 1,000 other neurons. So we have over 100 trillion neuronal connections inside our brain. These are called synapses. And the fact that human memory arises out of the electricity that flows between two neurons is still the biggest mystery. So we don't really understand how memory works. Now, if you ask those experts, they will tell you they do. But when you ask them to give you a simple answer that business people can apply, they don't. So I've been trying to teach people how, not so much how memory works, but what's most important thing to remember about what people will remember. And at the end of the day, I have a very simple formula. And I'll give you the formula, right? It's like memory is equal to number of repetitions of a phenomenon multiplied by the amount of emotion at the time of learning, multiplied by the position of the stimulus within the list. And that's the recency primacy effect. So let me repeat that, right? What people will remember is equal to the number of repetitions. I can explain that. It's very simple. Nobody ever learned the alphabet the first time they heard it. It took a lot of repetitions of your parents telling you what the alphabet is for you to remember it. Why? Because when you repeat the same sequence of things, the pattern of firing of your neurons will be the same. And this repeating the same pattern of firing of neurons creates new brain connection, which helps the learning process. Oh, by the way, you would even argue that we don't teach the alphabet by using a series of letters. We teach the alphabet by using a song. Why? Because the primal brain, that ancestral brain, doesn't understand words, but it understands music. It remembers the music. So the more your message can become musical and the more you will repeat it, the better for memorization. So that's the first factor. The second factor is emotion. Why? Because people cannot remember things that are not emotional. I'll give you a simple example. Peter, do you remember where you were on September 11th?
Yes.
Now, where were you?
I happened to be in Manhattan, about 20 blocks north of the Twin Towers.
All right. So there was only one repetition of September 11th. So you can probably name a lot of details of what happened to you that day, what you did, with whom you were, right? Where you had lunch. Do you remember where you had lunch, for example?
Yes, I took some of my totally freaked out company out to a Greek restaurant, and they're like, well, how can we do this?
All right. So Peter, you remember...
Everybody remembers that.
Right. You remember where you took people to lunch on that day. Now, do you remember where you had lunch 3 days ago?
No, of course not. No.
Probably not. So why is it that you still remember what happened 20 years ago versus not remembering what happened 3 days ago? What's the biggest difference? The biggest difference is on September 11th, your brain was flooded by various what's called neurotransmitters, so chemical reactions inside your brain, right? And these chemical reactions created such an emotional marking that it stole your brain. You cannot forget what happened today. In fact, the most extreme example of that is people who suffer PTSD. Now, if you live a very intense day in your life with strong emotion, you might not even be able to get out of that day in your brain. It's called PTSD, right? So you understand the second factor of emotion, right? The more emotion there is at the moment of learning, the more chances you have that your customer will remember what happened there. And then you still have to consider the fact that it depends on the position of your stimulus. So for example, imagine your customers organize a session, they do a bid, and they invite the top five vendors to present. So if there are five vendors that are going to come to present their solution, do you want to be number one, two, three, four, or five?
That's a great question. You know, that's certainly for advertising agencies, one of the most critical questions. I'm not going to answer that. You tell me.
So it would be a good idea to be either number one or number five.
Because I agree.
Of the primacy effect, right?
Yeah.
But if
yeah.
you have the choice between being number one and number five now, what should you choose?
I've always liked being last, frankly.
Yeah, good answer. Actually, why? Because the recency effect is slightly stronger than the primacy effect. So if you have a choice, better be last. In fact, you know, lawyers know this because they fight for the opening and the closing statements, right? George Lucas said, the secret to a good movie is create a hot opening, create a hot close, and just don't screw up in the middle. So again, if I go back to my formula, memory is equal to the number of repetition multiplied by the emotion at the time of learning multiplied by where the stimulus is within the list. So that's I teach people how to apply that very specific formula of memory to everything they do in sales and marketing.
Hi, I'm going to break in very quickly to this interview and tell you that I'm about to ask Patrick about how he moved his face-to-face business into an online business. But you'll note at the end that things get screwed up. I lost my internet connection. I couldn't reconnect to him and so forth. So this is a teachable moment. It'll be at the end of this podcast. I should have had a plan B. I should have discussed it with him. You need a plan B in case things get screwed up. I did not have that. But again, a teachable moment, as is this last part of the internet discussion, the discussion of how to move a face-to-face business into an online environment. Check it out. Here we go.
All right, I'm gonna have to let that permeate my brain. I'm gonna totally switch this conversation for a second, and I'm asking a question, something you and I talked about, and I'm very curious. So you are a very smart guy. You've got a very strong sales proposition. You know, frankly, I don't know one marketer that shouldn't be paying attention to some of the stuff that you talk about. I mean, it's just, you know, it's very smart, and I've seen you speak. Here's the question. Your business was getting on airplanes and going to meet people. Now you're doing it online. What are you adding to, this is completely different from things we've just talked about. Are you adding things to your business? Are you adding products and services because of the world that we live in today? How are you reimagining your business?
So actually, it's not like we added, it's like we changed. And we had to discontinue a whole bunch of our services, because right now nobody wants to do a strategic session and have 12 executives in one room with a guy who's going to fly from Lake Tahoe and who could potentially be contagious. So it's not like we added stuff. We've discarded a lot of services that we were selling before. And now we're going back to some of the core of what we can do for people. So we had to reinvent ourselves. And I'll give you a very simple example. Before the virus, our core session was a two-day executive retreat where we would invite the CEO, the CMO, the CSO, the CFO, all the top executive of one company in one room, and we would lock ourselves up. And at the end of that, we would answer three questions. The three questions are, what are the pains of our customers? What are our claims to eliminate those pains? And what would they gain, or what's our value proposition? So it would take us 2 days, 2 full days, 8 hours per day to do these brainstorms on what's the pain, what's our claims, what's their gain. So we can no longer do that. So we had to change that. And now we've replaced that with 6 2-hour remote sessions. So we still invite the same 12 people, but they do it from their home, right? From the home office. And I ask them the same question, but I had to slice down what we were doing into smaller chunks that are more digestible. So we've spread, instead of doing it on 2 days, it takes about 6 weeks. Over a 6 weeks period, we have a 2-hour meeting every week. So for example, we could say every Wednesday from 2 to 4 p.m., we're going to get together and we're going to work on these questions of pain, pain, gain. And amazingly enough, at the beginning, you know, when my partner and I were trying to reinvent our business, I never thought it would work, because I'm saying, we're screwed. I mean, if I cannot be in the same room with my customers, there is no way I can teach them all the thing I want them to learn. And there is no way I can build consensus remotely. That seems to be really mission impossible. So I was very negative that it would work. Now, if you fast forward 6 months later, and if you look at the experience that we have, we've done that, of course, now with dozens and dozens of customers, we've been able to achieve pretty much the same level of effectiveness of our workshop. And in some cases, it's even better. So how could a 2-day face-to-face meeting be better than a 6 times 2 hours remote meeting? And there.
Okay, as I mentioned earlier, this recording stopped abruptly. The good news was Patrick had made his point, so actually all was well. But here's again the point. I should have had a plan B. I did not. All of a sudden, when the call ended, my Wi-Fi shut down, the call ended, blah, 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 stop. I did not have, I'm going to say this for the fourth time, a plan B. You better have a plan B, especially if it's a sales call. That's the deal. Ciao.
This was episode 4 in our interview series on how to use virtual meetings to close sales. We have now interviewed 4 experts, including the number 1 advertising agency search consultant. So, listen to all and go out and win more business. Big thanks to Tim Ferriss for loaning us his podcast production team.